It looks like we have a room full of newcomers. So I'd like to welcome you to this, the newcomer ask, I think is the name of this workshop. So I certainly would like to welcome everyone here who's attending this workshop. My name is Dolores Scott, and I'm an alcoholic. Hello, everybody. And we are certainly happy to have you in our city, our lovely Atlanta. I'm a native Atlantan, and just so proud to have the Women's Conference here. We had it here a number of years ago. I think it was back in the 80s, sometimes in the 80s. So we are really happy to have the conference, the Women's Conference here again in Atlanta. So welcome. There are a lot of sights to behold here in this city and a lot of things to be seen, so I hope that some of you may be taking some of the tours. We have a wonderful panel today for discussion. We have women who are from all over the world. We have a young lady who's from Minneapolis, Minnesota. We have a young lady from Hilton Head, South Carolina. We have a young lady from London, England. So we are really privileged with our panel here today. Let's see if we can get this meeting started. The anonymity statement. In perfect honesty, I tell you how I do things. I'm a last minute person, so I had gotten my letter, I guess a few weeks ago, and I put it in my pocketbook and I didn't really read it, because I'm one who'll open a letter and then I'll say I'll go back and I'll read it later. That can wait. And lo and behold, today, I pulled the letter and I said, I better, you know, since that program is going to be today, I think I better pull that letter out and read it. And I pulled it out and I saw that we were supposed to have gotten together and we were supposed to have discussed what we were going to talk about and made our plans, none of which we did. I just read the letter, to tell you the truth, today. But then I thought, I think the thing that I was comforted by is that in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't make any mistakes. Everything will just, I said, we'll just flow through this. I don't have a thing planned. One thing that we did, the panelists and I did talk about, and the topic of this workshop is a newcomer ask. Well, I'm going to tell you the truth. Lord, I've been working so hard to become an old timer. So I'm kind of far removed from the newcomer, but not that far removed. I say that because here in Atlanta at the NABA Clubhouse, once a year we have an old timers meeting. And usually we have someone to come in from out of town who is the main speaker, and we have members of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Atlanta area who are on the program. And you have to be in the program 20 years to be an old-timer. And Lord, I had been working so hard trying. I want to be an old-timer. So this year, by the grace of God, one day at a time, in the company I keep, I was asked to be on the old-timers meeting. So I said, Lord, I've been working so hard trying to be an old timer. But just to give you my sobriety date, I came in a few 24 hours ago, and when I came in, the way it was explained to me is that if you can't remember your sobriety date, then you may not have one. So you need to always remember your sobriety date. And my sobriety date, let me see if I can remember it, because I'm an old timer. It's April the 28th, 1978, is my sobriety date. I have to stop and think about it, because it's a lot goes into that being an old timer. One thing that I thought about, and as the panelists and I were talking right before the meeting, and when we were thinking about newcomers, when I came in, I had so many questions. I made a lot of mistakes at the very beginning of coming into the program because there were so many things I did not know. But by the grace of God and the people in the program and the principles of the program, the program has worked for me one day at a time. And I'm just grateful for that, because as I look back now, I can see that there were other people. One thing that I did that they said not to do, I came into AA on the arms of a young man. He was a very handsome young man. And gosh, was he good looking. And so here we were, two drunks, going to come to AA and try to get sober. So we went to a meeting every night. But you know what? When I look back, I don't advise anybody to do this, because it was only after I had been in the program that I learned you don't come in hooked up with he and, they call it he and she and then. I don't know what they call it now. But they say you don't do that. But anyway, I did come in on the arms of this very handsome young man. I don't know if I helped him, but he certainly helped me when I look back, because we went to a meeting every night. We talked on the telephone every night about the program, and we planned to attend this anniversary over here, and we planned. So for those first 30 days in the program, it certainly helped me. Now, this same young man, some 20-some years later, has never gotten the program. He's still, and it's only, this is just my opinion. Everything I say up here is my own opinion. It's only by the grace of God that he's still alive, because he's been in, out hospitals and just bouncing back. I don't know how his spiritual, mental, and physical has stood the torture all of the years, but I'm just grateful that the program worked for me. The program, I guess, is not for everybody, but I'm just grateful that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked for me. Now, that was just one thing, and the other thing was that I didn't know when I first got here 24 hours ago that you weren't supposed to have a male sponsor. My first two sponsors were men. But it was only after I had been in the program that I understood that you, and it took me a number of years to get a woman sponsor. I just had a thing with the men. I don't know. But several years into the program, I did have to get a woman sponsor, because I ran into some women issues, and that I needed help from a woman, as it had to do with children and trying to raise families and stuff like that. So I made two big mistakes. God, I had two men sponsors when I first came into the program. One of them was like a grandfather figure in my life for me and for my children, and he taught me a whole lot. He was a spiritual giant in the Atlanta area in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's deceased now. He's been deceased since 1990, but his name was John Flemister. And he certainly taught me a lot. I'm still living today off of lessons that John taught me. John Flemister had the greatest capacity to give love than any person I have ever met in my whole life. And the way that John gave love was not to talk about it. He showed it. I remember one morning I had been, I don't know about you, some of you ladies or whatever, but I suffer with depression. And I had been hospitalized for depression, and I had come out of the hospital, and that next morning I was going to go to a meeting, an early morning meeting at 10:30. So John said, I'll be at your house at 9:30 to go with you to the meeting. And it was that he put into action his words. He taught me how to give love, and it was not by what he said, but it was about what he did. And he was there that morning, the next morning, to go with me to the meeting, and then we came back to the house, had lunch. And it just meant so much to me on that particular day, my first day out of the hospital, to have John there and to be supportive of me. So he taught me about love by what he did, his actions. There was only one other thing that I thought about, and like the panelists and I were talking, that we were going to try to talk from some of our own experiences. When I first came into the program, I was told to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. So one of the first questions that I had as a newcomer was that I was so hungry and I was so helpless and I was so hopeless, And I was the walking dead when I got here. I don't know if you ever heard about dead, but just ain't laid down. And that was the way that I was when I got here to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was dead, but I just had not laid down yet. Everything was dead. I was bankrupt, spiritually, physically, and mentally bankrupt. And now let me see. I forgot what I was fixing to say. But I was so hungry when I got here that I would grasp onto anything that I could hold on to because my vessel was so empty, my cup was so empty. I still don't remember what I was fixing to say, but anyway, maybe it'll come back. But one thing that I do remember is that my home group, the group that I made my home group, was a Tuesday night. It's the Easy Does It group, and it's still my home group, and we still meet at 8 o'clock on Wednesday night, and I still go to my home group every Tuesday night, and I go to other groups. But there was another group that was called the Cosmopolitan Group, and they, I know what I was saying, about 80, going to 9 meetings in 90 days. When I first came into the program, the treatment centers were not that prevalent at that time, so what we were told was to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I'm grateful for that, because this is everything I say here is my opinion. If I had started to go to treatment, I think I would have abused it, going over and over, but I'm just so grateful that when I came in, I was told to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. So one of my first questions as a newcomer was, I went back to this man who had, one of the men who had become my sponsor, and he was the one who had told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. So I went to 5 meetings, and then I went back and I told him, I said, now look, I done been to 5 meetings. I don't think I can go to 85 more meetings. So one of my first questions was, how in the hell are you going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days? I just couldn't. The concept of one day at a time. I had no concept of living my life one day at a time. And so he said to me, he gave me a piece of advice that I never forgot. He said, you do not have to go to 85 more meetings. You only have to go to one. And that's the one you're going to tonight. So he broke it down into a little bitty piece that I could handle. He said, you don't have to go. Because, see, that was some of my dilemma, I think, was, oh, God, here it is. Like today is whatever today is, February the 11th, Monday's going to be Valentine. My thing would be trying to stay sober for Easter. You know, and I hadn't even got through the day, you know, because that's the way my thinking would be. I just want to make sure when Easter comes, I'm sober. No, never mind the day, and never mind Monday, Valentine's Day, and all these days that come in front. So that was one lesson that Henry now also is deceased. But from my men sponsors and my women sponsors, I learned some lessons that still live with me today. I still go by them. One other thing, and then I'm going to turn the discussion over to my fellow panelists. There was one other thing that I thought about as being a newcomer. I had gone to this meeting. It was kind of like when I came in, we had more than one home group. I had my main home group. It met on Tuesday night, the Easy Does It group. But the Cosmopolitan was like my second home group, and they met on Thursday night. And then we had another group that we went to on Friday night. Back in those days, we would go from group to group to group, and it would be a group of us who went from group to group to group. And we went to Fulton County on Friday night. We went to Cascade on Saturday night. We went to John's house for the 12-step study on Sunday night. We came back to Fulton County on Monday night. We went to Easy Does It on Tuesday. So we just went, a group of us. So Cosmopolitan was like my second home group. I knew all the people in the meeting, and we were very intimate and very close to one another like a family. So on this particular night, I was new in the program, and I had gone down to Cosmopolitan to a meeting. And there was a... there was a hum and a there was a bustle, hustle or something in the air. People were talking and they were excited about something and they were planning something. And I was a newcomer. I had no idea of what was going on. But then I heard them talk about, oh, yeah, well, we're going to meet at such and such a time. And what time do you want to leave? And what time we get there? And then I heard something mentioned about Jekyll Island. And I didn't have a clue of what was going on. So after the meeting was over, and I went home, and there's a lady who was like a mother hen in the at the meeting. She's deceased now, so her name was Geneva Barrington. And if you had any kind of problem with City Hall, the mayor, the governor, go to Geneva. She would write a letter or make a telephone call. So Geneva was the kind of person. She'd handle anything. So anything that you wanted to be taken care of, go to Geneva. So when I got home, I called Geneva. I said, well, Geneva, what is everybody talking about? Where are you guys going, and what is it that you're planning? So then that's how I became introduced to my first Georgia State Convention. They were planning to go to Jekyll Island for the weekend to the Georgia State Convention. And the first words that came out of my mouth when Geneva told me, I'm a newcomer. I had no idea. I didn't even know that there were state conventions. But that was the beginning of my convention going and really enjoying in the program. We talk about the joy of living that comes in the fellowship of alcoholics. Now, God, we had fun. We didn't have much money, and we all cramped up into a hotel room, and I carried my daughter, and some of us slept on the floor. It was just so much fun just being together and eating together and going to meetings together. So that was the beginning for me of going to conventions, the Georgia States, and then I went on to the international. I was fortunate enough to go to two or three. I went to Montreal, Canada in 1985 to the international. And I went to Seattle, Washington in 90. I think I missed the one in 95, but I hope to go to the one. Is there going to be one in 2000 in Hawaii? 2001, I sure would like to go to that one. But anyway, that was the beginning for me. So I told Geneva, I said, well, now, okay, the meeting was over. Maybe it's about 10 o'clock, 10:30, now everybody's at home. And I called Geneva, and I said, and she told me where everybody was going. And I'm a newcomer. And I said, well, I want to go, and Geneva will work out anything. Geneva told me she lived about 40 miles from Atlanta, and I told her that I wanted to bring my daughter. Jan must have been, and that's our next panelist's name. Her name is Jan also. My daughter Jan must have been 11, 12, something like that. And I told Geneva that I wanted to bring her because in my active alcoholism, I had neglected this little girl. She was so hungry just to be with me, to be. So at the beginning of coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and for some of that healing to take place, that I'd make sure that Jan, when I went to conventions, that she went also because she needed the healing and she needed the fellowship and she needed the love. But anyway, to make a long story short so that I can sit down, Geneva can fix anything. Geneva said, you get in the car. Now, she'll tell you everything to do. She said, you and Jan get in the car and y'all drive up to my house. She lived in Temple, Georgia. And she said, get here about 4 o'clock in the morning or something. Whatever Geneva said, I'd do it. So here we go, me and Jan putting a few things together. I think I only had $20. But back in the late 70s, like 79 or whatever, you didn't need a whole lot of money. I was going to ride with Geneva and stay with Alex. Geneva told me who I was going to stay with. I was going to stay with another couple in the program. She said, now you and Jan are going to stay with Alice and Jane. You're going to ride with me. So at any rate, to make a long story short, I followed Geneva's directions, and I went to her house about 4 o'clock in the morning, and we waited on other people in the program. There were some Al-Anon friends that she had and some more people who were coming to her house, and we were all going to leave from her house, headed to Jekyll Island. God, it was the most fun that I had. Geneva lived on a lake, and that morning I was able to see the sunrise over the lake. It was the most beautiful thing. My daughter and I went to Jekyll Island. We had a ball. We had a wonderful time, and that was the beginning. So one of the things that I wanted to know as a newcomer was, what is this they are talking about, and where is it that they are going, and I want to go. And I'm just happy to report that I did get an opportunity to go, and I've been going ever since. I'm going to turn it over to Jan. Jan is from Minneapolis, Minnesota. She has a sister who lives here in Atlanta. She arrived early. She got here Tuesday, and she spent some time with her family, and then she checked into the hotel on Wednesday. Come on up, Jan.
I'm Jan, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. Hi. And one of the blessings of these conferences for the last few years is my sister is also here, and my daughter will be here also. So it's a wonderful get-together. Lots of relatives still out there someplace. I did write some notes because I'm having senior moments occasionally now, so I had some stuff that I wanted to be sure and say to you. This is my, first of all, I want you to know this is my, I started coming to these conferences in 1982. Tulsa, Oklahoma was my first one, and I've been coming ever since. The only one I missed was Philadelphia, was it? We had a funeral we had to go to, so I did miss that one. But I do, like one of the ladies said this morning, I write it in, I sign up, I'll sign up today or tomorrow, and for Hawaii, and then it's a commitment to myself, and it's on my calendar, and there it is, and I'm going to do it. And it's just a wonderful thing. I tell people it's kind of like an annual booster shot of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it just means so much to me to be here. I'm a little nervous. I have not. This is the first time I've ever been on a panel at one of these and spoken. So anyway, my date of recovery started May 5th, and I won't forget mine. I hope. Boy, if I do this, then I'm in trouble. May 5th, 1971. So I'll celebrate 29 years coming this May 5th. And thank you. One day at a time. One day at a time. And I was thinking, as you were talking, that really we're all newcomers every day, aren't we? So, but I'd like to tell you a little bit about my story, not too much, and then talk about some of the questions that I had when I first came in to this fellowship. Like so many of us, I was born into an alcoholic home. My mother was alcoholic, my father was alcoholic, and my mother divorced my father when I was 3 because he was alcoholic, and then she married my stepfather, who was alcoholic. And then they got divorced when I was a teenager because they just didn't get along real well. And then my stepfather married a woman who is alcoholic. And unfortunately, everybody that I've just mentioned has now passed. My mother died when she was 48 without any recovery. We grew up in Chicago. And, you know, it's funny. I knew the Serenity Prayer before I even got into this fellowship. I think that people had come to 12-step my mother, and I just as a child heard some of the program talk, and the first time I heard the Serenity Prayer after I got to a meeting, I was just dumbfounded because I could say it and I didn't know I knew it. It was very strange. I started drinking in high school, and of course all my friends were starting to drink too, and all the boys I dated of course drank, and continued on in college. And one day, my junior year in college, I was at a beer picnic, a college sorority deal with a fraternity, and there was this guy standing on a picnic table with a bowler hat on and a gallon jug of beer slung over his shoulder singing Al Jolson songs. And I said to this friend of mine, "Who is that? I want to meet him." Well, it turned out to be my now husband, who we will celebrate 45 years in June, which is an absolute miracle because we drank together for, the first 15, 20, I don't know how many until I sobered up. And then he came in about 8 years after I did. And it's really a miracle that we've been able to stay together. We have 5 children, and I'm expecting my 12th grandchild in 2 weeks. And I told my daughter Stephanie, don't come early. So I've been blessed to have been in attendance to most of the births of my grandchildren, which would never happen if I was out then. And it's just one of the many blessings that I've had. So this time I'm the designated videotaper, and she said, no crotch shots, please, Mom. My oldest daughter, as I mentioned, is in the program, and she's arriving tomorrow, and she would have been here today for this, but her 13-year-old had a head injury yesterday, which just threw me for a loop, and bad night's sleep. I'm so tired. I feel like a walking zombie. But everything's okay after he went to the hospital. And I thought this morning, what better place to be if something's going to happen that upsets you or frightens you? This is just perfect. And so I'm very grateful to be here. And he's okay, and she's okay, and she's coming, and it's all okay. After my husband and I were married, we went to Germany for 2 years, an army stint, and lived with a wonderful German family, and our first daughter, who will be here tomorrow, was born in Germany. And I can remember my landlady saying at that time, that during that year, I was nursing the baby, and she kept saying, now you have to drink lots of beer. She didn't speak much English. This is okay, you know. And that poor kid was probably born half schnockered. I didn't know. Back then, you didn't know. No doctor ever told you not to drink or smoke, and I was doing both. We moved back to the States, and my husband got a job in Minneapolis, and so we moved up there in 1957, and we've been there ever since, raising our family. And that's where I did the majority of my drinking. And as you know, God looks after drunks and children. I carpooled and had my kids in the car and friends' kids in the car. No seat belts back then. Just pile them in, you know, and go. And it's a pretty big miracle that nothing ever happened. For that, I'm just so grateful. I got to a point where I started asking, I was denying my own alcoholism, and yet I started to, because I didn't want to be like my mother. I said, I don't want to be like her. I never will, because I don't drink in the morning, and I don't act like in a social situation. I was a good girl. I was born good, and I grew up good, and the right manners and all this stuff. And so when I went out, I made darn sure that I acted okay. I didn't dance on tables or put lampshades on or do any of that stuff. But I was starting to think over those years that something was drastically wrong. It wasn't alcoholism, of course, but something was very wrong. And I got a lot of depression. And went to several different psychiatrists to try to get help, and they prescribed Valium or Librium, over the years I've taken just about anything you can name, and it's all been prescribed by doctors, and so I was drinking along with a lot of pills too. And I went to I remember going in to my OBGYN for checkups and so forth, and I'd say to him, I just don't feel good. I can't sleep. I feel I have this awful anxiety all the time. I'm scared a lot. I wake up at night, and that horrible, you all know, climbing the wall feeling that you get. And he would say, he did ask me if I drank, and I said yes, a little. And He said, well, why don't you cut down? Why don't you cut down to one drink a day? And I thought, okay, I'll try that. And so I would go home, and he didn't say how big a drink, right? So I found the biggest glass I could. Well, that went on for a while, and of course it didn't work at all. And then I tried switching brands, switching to beer and wine only. My kids were all ski racers, and so we'd pack up our Bota, a wine skin, you know, to go out to the hill to the races, and or rum, hot rum, in the winter. And all the kids knew that I drank, and that I had that there. And I was, when I finally came into the program, I was so filled with guilt and shame for the embarrassment that I caused my kids over the years, so many, 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 many times, birthday parties, everything. So I went on a mission at one point to try to stop drinking. And here are some of the things I did. That was my first question. I wasn't a newcomer yet, but I was asking the first big question, how do I stop drinking? And I thought, okay, I had been going to church and Sunday school since I was a kid. I thought, okay, I'll join a prayer group. That'll do it. So I joined a prayer group. And these women, they were wonderful, and they used to pray over me. And then I'd go home and drink. And so that didn't work too well. I continued going to church, and being a good mother, I took all my kids to Sunday school, and I used to drive them down to Sunday school, drop them off. I'd have my thermos of whatever and go to one of our beautiful lakes in Minneapolis. By the way, come to the convention in the International in July. We have a beautiful city. Yeah. And I'd sit by the lake and drink during the hour or so that my kids were in Sunday school, and then I'd go pick them up and convince myself I was a good mom. And once in a while, I would go into church, but have heavily, you know, the stuff you use for breath and everything. Then I decided, okay, I'll get really healthy. I'll join a health club, and I'll change my diet. And so I joined a health club, and I go work out. And this was back when the first health clubs were just starting to pop up here and there years ago. And I remember they had a juice bar. And so I go work out, and then I go sit at the juice bar and have carrot juice. And then I come home and drink. So that didn't work too well. I tried everything. Everything that you all have done, I tried. Nothing worked. I want to share about my last day of drinking. And over this time, too, oh, golly, my marriage was down the tubes. It was just virtually over. And no communication, nothing, no intimacy, nothing. And it was interesting. The kids fell into their roles of children of an alcoholic, to alcohol. My husband gives me carte blanche. I can share that he's recovering too now. So they were in the roles, and I had one daughter that always protected me and sat down with me and made excuses that mom was just tired, you know, all that stuff. The last day of my drinking, and I didn't know it was going to be my last day of drinking, and this is when I allowed God to come into my life. I still get weepy when I talk about it. I was supposed to go to a concert in the elementary school some of my kids were in, and this friend of mine was going to pick me up for the concert at about, I don't know, 6:30, and we were going to drop the kids off and go to this little concert. And I got dressed, and I came downstairs, and I thought, well, I'll just make one more drink just to tide me over and settle my nerves a little bit more. And so I poured a drink of Tanqueray gin, which was my husband's alcohol, and he used to get so pissed off at me for drinking that. He said, that's sipping drink. You can't. anyway, I'm standing there with this drink, waiting for my friend to come, looking out the window in the hallway, waiting for her, and I to this day, it has to be God. I walked into the kitchen, and for the first time in my life, I poured a drink down the drain, set the glass on the counter, and I just knew, not up here in my head, but in my soul, I think, that was my last drink. And thank God it has been so far. So I'm very grateful. But at the time, it didn't. I mean, it's been over a period of many, many years that I've seen that more and more and more as an act of allowing God to come into my life. My friend, we went drop the kids off at the school, and as soon as they were out in the car, I burst into tears, and she went and got another friend, and they took me to a hospital. I was just freaking. I was just out of it, sobbing and carrying on what they thought was a nervous breakdown, which it was. And the interesting part of this is these two friends were my drinking buddies. And the three of us used to get together in the afternoon and drink until the kids came home from school. And they're the ones that took me to the hospital. I'm sad to say that both of them have passed on and died of their disease plus other diseases that they got along the way. But I'm grateful to them for taking that step of getting me some help. And from there, a wonderful doctor who was in AA talked to me, and from then I got into a program. I was very, very sick. I needed a lot of psychiatric care. In fact, I was in the hospital for a total of 9 weeks of rehab and psychiatric care. 10 of the days were lockup in the psych ward. I kind of had a little psychotic break. I thought I was the Virgin Mary. I couldn't convince Charlie that I was. or my kids. One night I set up the crash scene. I got other patients out of bed and said, okay, you're Joseph, I set up the whole crash scene. One of my first questions that I know none of you had that experience, probably, of being in a psych ward or anything, but one of my very real fears when I first came in was, am I going to flip out again? Am I going crazy? That was not a real good experience. And I was terrified of that, and I was sitting talking to a person that I just forever will be grateful for, who happens to be a psychiatrist, or happened to be a psychiatrist, and helped me along the way those 9 weeks. And I said, will I flip out again? Will I be crazy for the rest of my life? And he just kind of leaned back in his chair, and he said, not if you don't drink. I thought, oh, it's that easy? Don't drink. That just kind of shot into me. It seemed so simple, you know, and yet it wasn't. But that was a good message for me to hear. And then when I remember the first time I heard about step two and the part about insanity. And of course, I was thinking in terms of being locked up and being crazy and psychotic and all that. And it took me a long time to come to grips with that and realize that insanity could mean emotional insanity. It could mean getting away from the program, getting away from God, behaving in ways that are in conflict with my value system and with all of you in this program. Another question that I had a lot about was, who's my higher power? And am I, okay, how much time do I have? It's over? Oh, help. Who's my higher power? And I really had to do some searching, although I'd always believed in God and had some faith, but kind of the wrong, it was like, God, what are you going to do for me, instead of the serenity prayer acceptance and so forth. And that just going to church wasn't what I really wanted and needed and hungered for. It was the spiritual part of this program that finally made that difference, and that took a while to get. And other questions were, what will people say? You know, what will friends, they won't talk to me anymore. I'll be an outcast. A woman alcoholic is a dredge of society, and da-da-da. I really was scared kind of about that. And when I finally got over that, I started just, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm damn glad I'm an alcoholic. I'm proud of it. I wouldn't have today what I do if I were not an alcoholic, if I were just one of those, someone this morning called them earth people. I can't remember which meeting I was in. That was fun. And how, the other question was, my God, how can I live without alcohol? And the first thing I thought of when I got in this program was, I have four daughters and one son. They'll probably get married someday. How can I go to their wedding? Talk about projection. How the youngest at that point was 7, and the oldest was 14, and here I was, oh my God, I can't live without alcohol. I have to, you know, at weddings and things like that. So it was all of those things that, with the help of the program, I came to realize that it's one day at a time, or even 1 hour at a time, at times, and I didn't need to worry about that until that time got here. The other main question was trying not to change everybody else. I mean, once I finished detoxing, I thought, oh my God, my husband's alcoholic, my my sister, my brother-in-law, and I just started taking people's inventory like crazy, and in their face, sending books and pamphlets and literature and just being really obnoxious about it, until I began to realize that I could work a little Al-Anon too, and not be so judgmental and taking everybody's inventory, only my own. I believe with all my heart that every answer I have to life in whatever area is in one of the 12 steps, and I have believed that for many years. I don't care what it is, what question, what issue, what anything. Your answer is in one of those 12 steps. The other things that have meant so much to me are the serenity prayer and living one day at a time, that whole concept of blocking out yesterday, tomorrow, and just being here and now. The slogans are so meaningful and so helpful. And when I say them, I get a kind of a peaceful feeling inside of myself. I that same thing happens when I say the serenity prayer. And of course, sponsorship and service are so important. And I just saw one of my sponsees walk in. Hi, Pam. I've learned so much from my sponsees. I've just, it's a blessing. Thank you for letting me share. I appreciate it. Love you. Oh, I'm supposed to introduce Maureen. Our next presenter is Maureen S. from London, England, who I have known for some years now and have visited in London.
Hello, everybody. My name is Maureen, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Maureen.
And I will say once again, I'm from London, England, which you can probably tell by the strange way in which I speak. It's interesting, I thought it was very interesting that Dolores introduced the panel as young ladies, and I loved her for that, because I've taken recently to calling myself a feisty old lady, but I'm really, I don't know what it means, but it sounds good, but I really am today a young lady, because my life began, I began living on the 19th of February, 1972, and I'm coming up 28. You know? A day at a time, a day at a time. This is, my life is my miracle, and this miracle I owe exclusively to this program. When I came into the fellowship on the 19th of February, I couldn't even tell you my name. There was nothing really of me. Yeah? I had no sense of myself. I had certainly no self-worth. I had no spiritual values because I had sold them all for the best friend I had, which was drink. I had no friends. I had, at that point, no social life. All I had was a job and a very, very, very professional exterior. And very few people, if any, could see the emptiness and the agony behind that exterior. You know, I was almost dead in a very spiritual, metaphorical way. Nowhere to go except to the fellowship. Tell you what it did have, apart from a job, and that was a religion. And it was a very, very negative religion which took to blaming God for the bad way I felt about myself. And that religion had one prayer. I call it today the serenity, not the serenity prayer, the sincerity prayer. The sincerity prayer, because it was so sincere. It was a prayer that I used to say regularly, usually in the morning, and it was, "Please God, get me out of this one and I'll never drink again." You probably know that. You probably followed that religion yourselves, yeah? Yeah. And my mother used to say, "Maureen, be careful what you pray for, because your prayers might one day be answered." And my prayers were answered in this fellowship. I got out of the life of being a drunk, a day at a time. And I got out by a miraculous way, yeah, a miraculous way. My professional persona was that of a librarian. So I spent my time dusting books, putting books on shelves, and trying to be intellectual, yeah. And in the social sciences section, we had two books. In the social sciences, mind you, section, we had two books. One was a book with a blue cover called Alcoholics Anonymous, which I never thought of picking off the shelf. But next door to it was another book called The Drinking Game and How to Beat It. Yeah? Wonderful, wonderful book. Because I knew that there was something wrong with me. I had, in my 15 years of drinking, managed us to put together my suffering, my emptiness, with what I was putting inside myself. And I thought, here it is. Here's the book that's been written for me to tell me how to drink like a lady, how to beat the game, which was, how can I, Maureen, learn to drink like a lady? The book had seven chapters, and I read a chapter a night for 7 days, and I didn't have a drink for 7 days. And I came to chapter 7 after reading 5-6 chapters about myself. It was somebody's drinking story. And chapter 7 said, if you want to give up this life, I suggest you do not do it alone. You go to an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. I closed the book, put it back on the library shelf, and forgot about it. That I didn't want. Until February 1972, when I couldn't live with myself anymore. And I knew what it was I had to do, which was to ring AA. Rang AA, and so ashamed of myself, I got myself to a meeting. But it was a meeting many, many miles away from where I lived. It was the other side of London. Yeah? I didn't want people in my neighborhood seeing me going into meetings where alcoholics hang out. You know, what would people think of me if they saw me going into an AA meeting? Because, you know, I'd come home, I'd fall out of taxis, I'd fall into the gutter, if I got home, that was. I'd come home at all hours of the day and night in all states of inebriation. And I thought nobody would notice, yeah? And then, me, an alcoholic, what will people think about me? So I went across town, and I got to the meeting. And I don't remember a thing about it. You say, this is about the newcomer asks. But I didn't ask because I didn't have a voice. And I certainly didn't have a name, and I certainly wasn't going to say, I'm an alcoholic, but I knew I was in the right place. That's the main thing. I knew I was in the right place. And after the meeting, people took me out for coffee. And I was so, so frightened of my fellow alcoholics. I wondered what it was they wanted from me. Yeah? And I didn't think that what it was they were doing was giving me something in order to be of service to this wonderful spiritual principle called sobriety. I didn't trust, and I didn't talk, but I sat there and I drank coffee. And I went to another meeting the next day, and that's how I went on. I didn't hear anything about 90 meetings in 90 days, but something was answering my prayer, something was guiding me. Of course, as the mists began to clear from this rather pickled organ here, we today call a brain. Yeah, I began to get very, very fearful. I began to get very, very fearful, but also I began to feel very, very loved. And I think the two were interconnected, because I was loved by my fellow alcoholic. Yeah, and my fear was that I'm not going to be able to do this. Yeah, I've been sober maybe 6 weeks, and I'm not going to be able to do this. And I had what I call today catastrophic fantasies. And those catastrophic fantasies were in the region of, what will I ever do if somebody offers me a drink? And I live with the fear, what do I do if somebody offers me a drink? Until one day I was able to speak that fear to the woman who was to become my sponsor. Do you know what she said to me? I never forget this, because I find it one of the most liberating things I've ever heard. She said to me, Maureen, have you ever thought of saying no thank you? Had I ever thought of that? Well, would an alcoholic ever think of saying no thank you to a drink? But it was the most liberating thing anybody had said to me to date. All you have to do is say no thank you. You don't give the excuses. Yeah. Nobody's going to knock you down to the floor and pour whiskey down your throat. Yeah. You'll say no thank you and people will hear you. I find no one of the most powerful words in the English language. I think it is the most powerful word in the English language. No, followed by yet, followed by yes. Because when I say no to a drink, I'm saying yes to this program, I'm saying yes to this fellowship, and I'm saying yes to life. I'm saying yes to a life of quality. Yet, my sponsor would, is a word my sponsor would use a lot, yet, you know. But, you know, I haven't done step two, I would say. I don't understand step two. I can't do step two. And my sponsor would say, yet. Yet is a positive word. Yet allows potential. It allows growth to happen. Yeah, there can be a downside to that.
The original master recording cut off at this point.